Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, a very goodly first afternoon of the season after we've won a game thing to you.
And the same to you, Andrew. Goodly afternoon indeed. Nice to be able to say that.
It is, isn't it? It is. I've felt good all weekend. You know, Friday night can be one of those tricky games where if it goes wrong, your weekend is pretty much in the toilet straight away. But You win, you can relax then on Saturday, you can relax on Sunday, you can hope and pray that all the other teams have a terrible time. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Some of them had a good time, and I hate that. But for the most part, you know, it makes for a nice weekend. And when you consider, let's say, the first Arsecast Extra of last season compared to this one, I think this is going to be a bit more upbeat.
That's fair to say. I also think it's worth, sort of for context, thinking back to how, you know, you, the listener, might have felt when those fixtures were announced and the opening night was Friday night away from home at Crystal Palace. I think we probably all felt a sense of dread about that, given our experiences last season and given, you know, the defeat at Selhurst Park in the spring. So to come away with a win and a clean sheet, 3 points, some goals. Oh, we're a hell of a lot better off than we were this time last year. That's for sure.
That is for sure. And it was enjoyable in its way. There were things, obviously, that I obviously we'll discuss now that we could have done better, but still quite a few positives to take away from the performance. And, you know, first and foremost, though, you know, to get a win, I think you're right. There was that, you know, that sense of fatalism when the fixtures were announced. It was like, oh, they're doing us again on Friday night. Oh, Neville and Carragher are going to fucking have their tap dancing shoes on. You know, when Palace win, they'll put on their fucking tuxedos and do a Morecambe and Wise routine, tippity-tapping, dancing up and down the sidelines with the Palace fans. We can all see it. And, you know, by the end of the game, the Arsenal fans were so comfortable with the scoreline after that second goal went in that they just sort of turned their attention to serenading Patrick Vieira from the stands, which was really nice. I enjoyed that aspect of it. I'm sure Patrick Vieira didn't as much as we did, but nice to show him the affection and everything else, but nice to be in that kind of position where you can do things like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and to be fair to Vieira, like, he's kind of had Arsenal's number to a certain extent since he arrived at Palace. They got the 2-2 draw at the Emirates, didn't they, where we were very reliant on a late equaliser. Then they beat us in the reverse fixture. So he's shown that he knows how to set up a team against Mikel Arteta's Arsenal more than many managers in this league. Nice to be able to give him a little salute. I think only probably we all felt comfortable to do that once that second goal went in. But yeah, I think this was a better result than a performance, probably. But it's a really good result. And I think when you look back at Palace's form last season, I think they took 10 points off, you know, the top six sides at home, which is pretty decent. And I think it's one of the tougher away trips in this league. So they'll be very, very satisfied with that, especially when you look ahead and, you know, the fixture list after this game with Palace out of the way looks relatively kind. So there is kind of optimism we could build a bit of momentum, maybe.
Yeah, that's true. I must just remind myself, I know it's Leicester next weekend, but
it's Bournemouth after that away and then Fulham at home.
Right.
So, decent little run before we go to Old Trafford.
Fulham looked quite good against, well, I know Liverpool were not great, but Fulham looked not bad.
I mean, Mitrovic will cause anyone problems, I think.
He's a big fucking guy, isn't he? He's a big
wasn't
guy.
Quite a fair fight at the back post when they slung that cross up in the air. I don't know if you've seen it, but him up against Trent Alexander-Arnold is a bit of a mismatch, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, his forearm is basically, you know, the size of, I don't know what it is. There's no way Trent was getting up there. You know, people can criticize the defending, and I don't think defending is necessarily his strongest aspect or the strongest aspect of his game, but, you know, it is, it's sort of like Santi Cazorla versus, I don't know, Peter Crouch at the back post. Not quite that much, but, you know, there was a distinct advantage. So, yeah, no, you're right. But you take nothing for granted, obviously, in the Premier League. And if you're, as Liverpool showed, if you're not on your game, teams can take points off you. So we've got to be cautious. But I think you're right. This was, you know, on paper anyway, the most tricky of the opening five fixtures.
Well, whatever happens, we'll be in a better position after three games than we were after three games last year. That's guaranteed.
Guaranteed straight away. The team, no surprises. Mikel Arteta chose the same team that he put out against Sevilla. Played, I think, more or less 80 minutes with that team. So I don't know that really merits any great discussion.
There wasn't much to report there. I guess Kieran Tierney being back and on the bench was newsworthy, I suppose, because he was one of the players who hadn't really participated until this point. But, you know, I think we all knew what the starting 11 was going to be. And I suppose the only thing worth saying about that is it speaks to the benefit of the preparation Arsenal have had in this pre-season. They've had such disjointed pre-seasons in recent years for different reasons. And this time, you know, they had a lot of the squad together. There wasn't quite the same turnover in terms of numbers or staff. They've had these two trips to Germany and to America, which have been really beneficial. They've been able to field the same lineup in the two friendlies before going into the Premier League. I mean, that's almost unheard of. So I think, you know, hopefully we're going to see in these first few weeks the benefit of not just a proper pre-season, but a very settled pre-season.
Yeah.
And I think that's really valuable to a coach and his staff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you heard the preview podcast on Patreon when I was talking to Dan from HLTCO, the Crystal Palace.
They've had the opposite situation. I didn't hear the pod, but they've had a chaotic
pre-season. Yeah, that's what we said. Half the team is in Australia and the other half is over here. And, you know, there might be some benefits, but I really don't know that that's ideal when you're going into a new season. And you know, you wouldn't necessarily have said from their performance on Friday night that this was something that really troubled them. But you never know in terms of football just how the marginal gains make sufficient difference in a game, you know, in a match, if you know what I mean. So maybe if they had their preseason together, they could have been even better on Friday night. I don't know. But let's talk about the first 20-25 minutes from an Arsenal perspective, because it was very good. It was a really bright start to the game. We were front-footed. We were aggressive. We moved the ball quickly. We ran at the defenders. And I think deservedly took the lead in that period. Could have scored the Martinelli chance. I think he should have scored. Didn't seem to quite sort his feet out. But Gabriel Jesus, it looked like just a matter of time before he was going to do something to create a goal or get a goal himself. It didn't quite happen, but he was just unbelievable in those opening 20 minutes or so.
Yeah. I mean, the footwork from him, I think it was in the build-up to the Martinelli chance, was just sensational. And there was another moment relatively early on where he kind of pinned his man on the halfway line and span round him. He was a live wire. And Arsenal were electric in that first 20 minutes. And I have to be honest and say, I wasn't particularly surprised. That was kind of the Arsenal I expected, given what we've seen in pre-season against Chelsea and against Sevilla. I know the Premier League's a different matter, but I thought we're going to start with real intensity. And Palace, you know, couldn't get a foothold in the game at that particular time. And your only fear was, you know, Arsenal going to get the goal that this warrants, or goals, arguably. Because, you know, when you play in a kind of such a blitzy, devastating fashion for a sustained period like Arsenal did, you really want to reap the rewards of that. And when a couple of chances went awry. I think there was the Martinelli one and maybe like a half chance for Zinchenko, you know, out on the left-hand side. Mm. You just worry that it's going to get away from you. But fortunately, Martinelli made amends, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did. Set-piece goal. I was just, while you were talking there, I was just trying to look up how many set-piece goals we scored last season. And I can't find it because I'm distracted. But set-pieces are becoming or are an important aspect of how this team gets goals. Mm-hmm. They threw up some stat on Sky, I think, about how many set-piece goals Crystal Palace had conceded. It was a nicely worked routine, wasn't it? It really was.
Yeah, really, really well worked. I mean, you know, Zinchenko, not the obvious choice, really, to aim a ball for at the back post. And maybe that's what makes him the right choice. And he does well to get it back across the goal. And Martinelli's in the right place at the right time. But even if he wasn't, you know, there's a few other players sort of hovering at that back post, potentially to put it away. I think Gabriel might be there and possibly Saliba as well. So, yeah, really well worked. And it came off an absolute treat. And I was intrigued after the game. Arteta said, oh, yeah, one of the set pieces guys came up with it.
And, yeah.
You know, last season it was always Jovo who was getting the credit. I wonder if they've expanded that department or added somebody else there potentially. I don't know.
Head of
but
kicking.
It was an interesting answer.
Yeah, it was. I mean, maybe they have workshops or whatever. I don't quite know.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I don't know.
There comes a point where I think, you know, what can you do that's new? Do you remember, like, was it last season or maybe a couple of seasons ago where you would get all the players huddled in the middle together? And then they'd break off into various...
Yeah, the train. The train.
Yeah.
Love train, I think.
And then you'd have another one where, you know, a lot of players would stay outside the box and then make their way in when the delivery was made. But, I mean, there's a finite number of things you can do with players from corners and set pieces. But that one worked very, very well. It was a good header back by Zinchenko as well. And I thought what, you know, the little bit where Zaha had to make a decision whether or not to go with Ben White or Zinchenko. They sort of pulled him around a little bit.
I do wonder, I mean, I don't wish to take any credit away from anybody, but I do wonder if potentially the idea was for Zinchenko to meet it on the volley, but which would feel a little bit like it made a little bit more sense. But if that was the case, it was great improvisation from him and a really good header back across goal. And, you know, like I say, poacher's instinct from Martinelli to put it away.
Right. So, I mean, a problem I think that we had last season was going ahead and then not quite sitting back, but not building on the goal, not building on the momentum that we had. And there was perhaps an element of that after we scored, because it was a fairly intense opening 20, 25 minutes, you know, which we dominated, I think, certainly in terms of passing, in terms of territory, in terms of chances. I mean, there weren't loads of chances, but, you know, there was one team that looked like it was going to score, and it wasn't Crystal Palace. But then Palace got back into it. We did have a number of questions, actually. Let me see if I can find one here. I saw it there a second ago. Oh, yeah, it comes from Prakash Narayan, who's at T or Tyron underscore 11. And he says, why do you think we still fall back to the low or mid block when Arteta clearly wants the team to press high even after taking the lead? Is it a mental thing? Is it a physical aspect? And I don't quite know what it is. I certainly don't think it's instruction. And I think we've seen enough and heard enough from Mikel Arteta at this point to know that it's not an instructor. Like, okay, guys, when you score, just, you know, settle down, let them have the ball for a bit. Actually, let them in our half, you know, let them throw a few crosses. I don't think that's what's happening, but it is still something that is part of our game in the way that we react when we score a goal.
Yeah, it certainly was an issue we faced last season. I think inevitably we always look at ourselves. I have to be honest and say that my impression in the stadium is that Palace really adjusted and adapted what they were doing in that last 15 minutes of the half. And it presented us with problems that we didn't solve instantly. So I think it's always a two-way
sure.
street. You know, they started giving us a lot less time on the ball in our own half. They started flooding back in much greater numbers to prevent us getting the overloads we were getting. So they found a foothold in the game eventually, which is kind of inevitable with a home team. Very difficult to sustain that kind of football away from home. But it is something that Arteta, I think, will have hammered home. I mean, having seen what we've seen from him in the documentary, you can almost imagine what his halftime team talk would have been. And it would have been about trying to recapture that intensity, playing up the pitch. Because watching that first 20 minutes, the simplicity of it and the beauty of it is basically you're playing in the opponent's half, right?
Yeah.
And subsequently, you know, the level of threat you face and the level of threat you provide are much lower and higher, respectively. And that's the trick for this team. And I do feel that the additions that we've made and the way we're setting up is all designed around getting us playing in the opponent's half much more. You know, to borrow Paul's analogy from the Arsenal Vision podcast, it's about getting the toothpaste right up the tube. And you know, when you look at the way we kind of set up with White and Zinchenko almost stepping into midfield and just the two centre halves at the back and, you know, five lanes of attack, it's kind of a 2-3-5 camped in the opponent's territory. That's where Arteta wants us to be and what wants us to go. Why exactly we can't sustain it, it's really difficult to say. I think I would be fibbing if I told you
answer. Yeah. Because, you know, I don't quite or can't quite explain it fully either, other than games change and momentum changes. And sometimes it is hard to halt momentum when it goes against you. And, you know, away from home on a Friday night, noisy crowd, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and I did think, you know, I think this was an overwhelmingly positive night from an Arsenal perspective, certainly in terms of the result, the clean sheet away from home, you know, putting some shit to bed, if you like, as well, based on last season. You know, our last away game last season was pretty traumatic, and certainly playing at Crystal Palace last season away from home was traumatic. It didn't go the way we thought. So, you know, I'm not trying to dwell on any negatives here, but during the second half, I was looking at the bench and I was thinking, you know, what do we do here? How do we change it? How do we try and get back into this game, get a hold of it, get a grip of it? And I was looking at the bench and thinking, there isn't really that player there. Like, there, you know, if you'd had Smith Rowe on the bench, if you'd had Fabio Vieira on the bench, you're looking at those two players as like, okay, they can come on and they can, you know, give you some control. They can give you maybe something different from a technical perspective. But that sort of struck me that maybe there's still room for something else in games like this, because there are players on that bench that, you know, if we needed a goal, you know, you can bring on Eddie, you can bring on Nicolas Pepe, for better or worse, for the flaws that we've discussed time and time again. If you need a goal, he is certainly somebody who could help you get one if he can come on and get to the level of a game. But it's an interesting thing to consider, maybe, that when you're ahead, and when you're not necessarily in the Rob Holding moment, where you're bringing Holding on to just hold on, no pun intended, you know, that other kind of player who can come off the bench and have an impact on a game quickly would have been pretty useful on Friday night, I think.
Maybe, yeah, because it did feel like something was required to slightly shift the pattern and the momentum. I mean, I'm as delighted as anybody that we won. But I do think that apart from the first 20 minutes, it wasn't massively anything to write home about in terms of the performance. And I think that there are lots of games like we had like this last season, sort of 50-50 games, some of which we won, some of which we lost. And they're basically big moments in the penalty areas went in our favour. You know, we got the goal off the set piece. We got an own goal and they missed a couple of very, very good chances, you know, one either side of half time with Edouard and then Eze. So it was fine margins. But I guess what we've been told is that Arsenal are trying to add players with a mentality who know how to work those margins in their favour.
Yeah.
And I did think watching the game, that was another thing I thought, the advantage of signing in Zinchenko and Jesus, players who know the country, know the league, who've played at Crystal Palace countless times, who know what it takes to go away from home in this division and get a result. I do think the value of that is enormous. Like, there's almost no acclimatization or adaptation period. It's straight in and they get it. You know, okay, they've got to figure out their teammates and their movement and the relationships, but they absolutely know the task that's required of them and they come with the highest standards. And I just think there's a big advantage for Arsenal in that.
I think you're right to say that there wasn't much to write home about in terms of the performance, but Mikel Arteta spoke about the resilience of his team.
Yeah.
There were a couple of very good saves by Aaron Ramsdale, which I think we should point out. He had that moment with the ball at his feet where you, like, I'm not saying this is entirely down to that, but I do think that that got the crowd going a little bit. It did, in some way, help change the momentum from a Palace perspective, where we had control, and then you had this moment where everyone's a bit like, ooh, what's happening here? And I do wonder if that maybe had an impact on how the, you know, the subsequent 15 minutes of that half went. But
he had another one shortly afterwards where he was a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That pass, as I recall, yeah.
But he did make a very, very good save in the first half from Edouard. It was a header. Got himself across very well. And one in the second half as well, where he got down very quickly. I think, was it Eze
who was through on goal? Yeah, when Odegaard was sort of... White was caught on the wrong side of the pitch.
Yeah.
And Odegaard found himself playing right back.
That is not... Like, I love Martin Odegaard.
I don't want to see him defending at the back post against Mitrovic. That is for sure.
No, and I feel like some of the most difficult moments Martin Odegaard has had in an Arsenal shirt have come when he's sort of back defending in that area. You know, penalty, was it against Manchester United last season? You know, couple of moments where things have not gone that well for him. But look, it was a very, very good save from Ramsdale.
Yeah, I thought he made two massive saves.
Yeah.
And was great in those moments. Weirdly, I thought all round it probably wasn't his cleanest game, but I guess for goalkeepers, moments are a big thing. I do think that the sort of kicking errors, like, for example, the one that was blocked, I do think that that's just something that is going to happen time to time when you ask your goalkeeper to play very ambitiously on the ball. And in that moment, he was actually trying to play in Martinelli, who was making a curved run on the halfway line. Right. I was sat at that end so I could see. And I do sort of think, although it is terrifying, don't get me wrong, it is terrifying. We all feel like Aaron Ramsdale's dad in that moment, having to turn away and walk away. You know, I saw quite a lot of City and Liverpool last season, and there are scary moments with their keepers too. And I just think when you place that much responsibility on a player who's probably less technically gifted than any outfield player, you are going to see that time and time and again. The interesting thing is, I do think that probably it has a, what's the word, like a kind of permeating effect, where it probably does affect the principles of the play a little bit. I think it does probably bleed into other players' consciousness and nerves and the crowd. So it's just one of those risk reward things, right?
That
comes with that territory.
Yep. And look, he did play a couple of really, really good passes as well. So
sure. He got his Twitter clips. Don't worry about that.
So look, I think I was making the point about resilience, and that's what kind of pleased Mikel Arteta, because you know, apart from those two saves that Ramsdale made, I don't really think Palace threatened that much, despite the fact I think they were pretty much on top for most of the second half, and we couldn't really get ourselves into the game in a significant way from an attacking perspective. Which brings us, of course, to two players, two individuals who are obviously worthy of mentioning here. I'm going to leave William Saliba just for a second, because his debut was fantastic and we can discuss that. But I was really taken aback, is not the right way to say it, because, you know, variances in opinion over matters in football shouldn't be any surprise. But I was a little surprised by the perception of Ben White's performance among many fans.
Yeah, it's really, it's genuinely really interesting. I've rarely known such a divide of opinion on a performance. And I've got to say that in the press box, overwhelmingly, the opinion was sort of quite negative. I mean, I won't mention any names, but I know Arsenal, a couple of Arsenal reporters who were doing player ratings, and I know one gave him a 5, another gave a 6, and sort of said he struggled. And then I know a lot of people who also thought he did really well. But it was it was interesting, like within the stadium, or certainly within the press box, the perception was quite negative. It's fascinating. I guess, you know, I know you don't want to discuss William Saliba yet, but I guess maybe it's a case of we must choose one or the other.
Yeah, yeah,
we cannot possibly pray for both.
We had this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? Like, you know, the Saliba stands versus the Ben Shite fucking ultras, whatever it is. Look, I
what did you think of Ben White?
I thought he... I tell you why I think there is a perception of his performance not being good, is that maybe in the first half there were a couple of misplaced passes, fairly simple misplaced passes, which we know he is much better, he's capable of a lot better than that. And I do think that maybe those misplaced passes have gone some way to informing the way people think about the way that he played. You know, what did Wilfried Zaha do in the game? I mean, he got a lot of the ball, and he was
their game plan as ever, right? And that was, I think, that contributes to the perception. This idea that, well, look, they're clearly looking for the space in behind Ben.
Therefore,
White.
He's weak.
Yeah, yeah. I think that informs it. For me, Zaha is kind of the key factor in this. I mean, there are very few players one on one in the Premier League who are more difficult to play against than Wilfried Zaha.
Yeah.
I really, really, really think that. And I think you could have put Tomiyasu. I think you could have put Bakary Sagna. I think you could have put any good right back up one-on-one against Zaha and say, Palace are going to launch balls in behind you all day long. Good luck with that. And there would be moments where they looked stretched, shall we say.
Yeah.
Because it's a difficult job for any right back, let alone a guy who is sort of learning that position effectively on the job. And I think given that, he did very well, you know. I think Arsenal, as a overall, won the battle on that side of the defence. And it was a joint effort at times. You know, so when White couldn't quite get there, Saliba did. Mm. And I think, you know, that was Palace's game plan and Arsenal were able to shut it down. Were there some nervy moments? Were there some moments where a last-ditch intervention was required or a really good tackle was required? Absolutely. Did Ben White pick up a booking? Absolutely. But it was just part of the battle. And ultimately, I guess the clean sheet speaks for itself.
Yeah. Zaha had one shot in the game. And I think, you know, you're never going to have, I think you're absolutely right to say he would give most right backs, I think every right back in the Premier League, you know, will have a challenge against him. We know he's a difficult guy to play against because he's good on the ball, he's tricky, he's fast, he's strong, he's tall. You know, he likes to complain. We know that. When things
it's a
don't
psychological
go-
game against him
yeah,
as well.
Exactly. It's like
it's mental side.
Relentless against him. Like every time something doesn't go his way, he's like pounding the ground as if the universe has, you know, done him in completely. So I think
I asked Arteta about how Ben White did at right back. And I said, oh, you know, he was up against a difficult opponent. And if you watch the video back, when I said, you know, he's up against a difficult opponent, Arteta actually laughs. Because he's like, yeah, he's difficult. And he spoke about the kind of mental side and how Zaha kind of winds you up, not just through, you know, the way his character, but also his style of play is kind of aggravating. You know, he's sort of taunting you into tackles at times. I think Ben White coped admirably with that. And I was really struck that Arteta said afterwards that he likes playing there. You know, he quite likes playing at right back.
I thought he did well. I really thought he did well. 8 tackles he made on the night.
The absence of Tomiyasu, do we have a more natural right-back who would have done better? I don't think so.
I think Cedric would have had a... Like, I'm not saying this to be critical of Cedric, but I think Cedric would have had a more difficult time against Zaha. I think there is something about, you know, the physical aspect of playing against somebody like Zaha. And Ben White, you know, is a fairly big guy, strong, is used to those duels in the center of defense. And look, the thing that I was going to say a few moments ago was the passing from the back from Joachim Anderson was unbelievable.
Yeah, that guy has got
superpower. Holy shit. I mean,
it was the same last season. He played the pass, didn't he, got them in behind. But, I mean, yeah, he really does have a superpower there. It's almost like a kind of Rory de Lapp's throw-in thing where it's like, you know, he is a game plan in himself, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. That's what Dan was saying on the preview pod, is that like they use their center halves to build play. And when you've got somebody with that kind of passing range, you know, some people will say, well, it's long ball. Nah, that's not long ball. Long ball is when you just fucking lump it downfield and you hope for the best. This is like laser-guided, precision, long-distance passing, and it was hugely impressive. Now that I can sit here and talk about it, knowing that we've won 2-0 and kept a clean sheet. During the game, I have to say I was a little less enthused by the time and space he was allowed to make those passes. I was wondering, you know, could we have done more? And I'd need to go back and look at those long passes again and just see how maybe they built space for him at the back.
It'd be interesting because obviously, you know, the high press has been a big feature of our preseason. I do wonder if it's as simple as we were focused on, you know, cutting out the shorter passes. So, you know, when the centre-half is in possession, we're thinking, right, you know, let's block off the lane to the fullback or let's block off the lane to the holding midfield player.
Yeah.
And they were just bypassing that a lot of the time. Yeah. But yeah, he really can pass that way.
And that's it. I mean, I think that as well adds to the idea that, okay, if the pass is good and it lands in a place where Zaha can get it and not be cleared by Ben White as a header, people are looking at it and thinking, has Ben White done something wrong there? And I don't think that's the case. I just think the quality of the passing was really, really good. So yeah, for me, I thought Ben White had a very, very good game. A very good game. I know some people won't agree, but there you go. Let's talk Saliba then, because that was a very, very, very impressive Arsenal debut.
He was really excellent, I thought. He was Arsenal's best player on the night. And, you know, you do forget, because we've been talking about him for years, you do forget quite how young he is. And I think when you add that layer of context to it, he's 21 and he's not long 21. I mean, he's not 22 until March. I know he's played a lot of football at that tender age, but to come into the Premier League...
Well, that's good. That's the good thing, you know?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it was interesting after the game. You know, again, depending on which side of the Saliba wars you were on, there were different perceptions of the, you know, the ramifications of the performance. I noticed a lot of people saying, oh, he should have been here last season or whatever it might be. I think we've got to let bygones be bygones at this point. And this was an excellent debut. The time was right for him to come in. Listen, I don't think Palace they lost a lot of goal threat in Conor Gallagher, that's for sure. And they've not quite replaced that. But I still think that players like Edouard, like Ayew, like Mateta, who came on, they're a handful. You know, Mateta especially he can be a bit ungainly, but he's a real physical presence. And Saliba stood up to everything. His composure at such a young age has always been a facet of his game, but it is remarkable. And I mean, listen, I've always been a fan of him as a player, but it's... size is one thing, like 6'1" or whatever he is. Like in real terms, you know, I'm 6'1".
He's bigger than that, isn't he?
Maybe he's 6'2", 6'3". Whatever he is, it's presence.
Yeah.
I think his size is complemented by presence. And that is a kind of X factor quality that is more difficult to define. And I think it comes with confidence, assuredness, authority. And he exudes all of those attributes. And it makes him look and feel about 8 feet tall on the pitch and about 4 feet wide.
Yeah, he's 1.93 meters tall, which is 6 foot three and a bit. So
okay, so he is taller than 6'1". That makes sense. But even so, he's just got such a commanding presence, and he dealt with the occasion superbly. There were some brilliant, well-timed tackles. One on Zaha in the box that was excellent. There was another one that got pulled back for an early foul by Partey, which was almost a shame because it was such a beautiful tackle.
Yeah.
His distribution was very consistent, very solid. I mean, you couldn't... I don't want to go overboard because it's one game and the hallmark of any defender is consistency, sure. You know, any great defender. But this was an incredibly encouraging debut.
I agree. And you can talk about size, like, you know, it matters, but it's not necessarily always you need more than that.
He has to be complemented by the right, you have to know how to use it. and he absolutely does. I mean, yeah, and you know, looking at that central defensive pairing, him and Gabriel, it's a pretty domineering partnership at the back from a physical perspective.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a, you know, if you look across the back four now, you know, we've got some serious presence there when you've got White, Saliba, Gabriel, Tomiyasu. I know Tierney and Zinchenko aren't exactly massive, but you know, we do have that presence there. I have to say, I looked at Saliba and I watched him closely, obviously, because it was his debut and because there's just been so much talk about him, and because, you know how much I love a good centre half as well. The composure, I know you use that word, was just unbelievable. Mm. You know, the way he was waiting for players to just move towards him before he'd knock off the pass. He wasn't flustered at all. There was a couple of moments with Zaha where he chased him back into the corner. You can look at a defender sometimes and go, I can see the panic in the way you're running. And even the way you're moving, I can see you're terrified of what this attacker could potentially do to you.
Yeah.
But there's literally none of that. He looks for passes. There were a couple of very good forward passes as well. Nobody else made more passes on the night with a higher percentage completion rate than William Saliba. 94% completion rate of his passes. And, you know, when you look through the team, you know, someone like Xhaka, who's usually very high, had only 85%, which isn't bad for a midfielder, but 71, you know.
Partey wasn't great. Certainly in the attacking half, his passing completion was pretty low.
Yeah. So, you know, even Martin Odegaard.
Gabriel didn't have his best night generally, I didn't think. And Saliba, you know, certainly looked the more assured of the two centre-halves on the evening. Yeah, he's very good on the ball, and he's got a neat trick, like you say. I saw this a few times at Marseille where he'll kind of invite the press, he'll invite the attacker to get close to him and then either play the pass or make a little turn. He just exudes like a kind of coolness, essentially, a cool-headedness,
which
belongs to a player who's basically been the best player at every youth level through and to senior level and just has a natural confidence. You can see it.
I said to you last week, he's a serious dude, but he's like, it's not just the expression on his face. It's the way he does his job.
Exactly.
Like he absolutely is there to fucking stop you. If you're the attacker, like it's personal stuff, you know, I'm not letting you through.
Yeah.
And I love that.
And for all the talk and all the debate of like, how good is he? Like the one person I know doesn't have any doubt at all is him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he has absolute confidence on the pitch, and that's a huge component for any elite athlete. So, yeah, it was, I think it was quite a startling debut because of how much has preceded it and the level of expectation, the level of attention, and the way in which he just brushed it all off his very broad shoulders.
Yeah.
Was very admirable.
Yeah, I mean, he was. I don't know if you saw the post game interview on Sky, Jeff Shreves.
I have seen it.
Yeah, and it's sort of obviously like, oh, it's taken 3 years, blah blah blah. But like, I think you could make a case that maybe last season William Saliba would have got football at Arsenal. You know, he was good enough, I should say, to get football at Arsenal, right?
Yeah. I mean, we barely had a centre half at the end of the season. It was we were chucking people out there with injuries.
Exactly, so, yeah. But we didn't have Europe, and we didn't have the ability to rotate as much, and we didn't need to rotate as much without Europe. So the decision to send him on loan, as I've said on here many times, I understand it when you send a then 19-year-old defender out, or was he 20? I don't know. You know, just gone 20 years of age. To play a full season for Marseille or wherever it was that he was going to play. And the benefit of that to the player is obvious. And I think the benefit of that to Arsenal this season, based on one game, is also obvious. And I don't believe for a second that our inability to finish in the top four was because we didn't have William Saliba last season. I think there were other factors at play, which we've discussed at length. And I don't think it was just, you know, Saliba's absence wouldn't have been sufficient. I think it was the other absences, key injuries, you know, goal scoring problems, striker, et cetera, which really cost us. But, you know, it was just so encouraging to see him come in, do his job, talk about that, you know, situation, say the right things. I mean, he's got an incredibly deep voice as well, doesn't he?
Yeah. I imagine he spoke like that since he was about six.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he had the goatee then as well.
Yeah.
What's interesting as well is obviously the relationship with the manager has been a huge focus. And Saliba's been pretty public about that, elements of that, that, you know, he wasn't happy with or felt he wasn't given a chance. Certainly the manager is now saying all the things you'd want him to say.
I think he's always said that. I think genuinely, he's pretty much always been upfront about Saliba. Like, because there was that fuck up where we didn't loan him, right? And we should have done. As a football club, we let him down there. That was not good. But I think Arteta's always been upfront about, like, wanting to do the right thing by what he feels is the right thing by the player. Mm-hmm. You know, and the idea or the perception that somehow, because he sent him on loan and then sent him on loan again, Mikel Arteta hates William Saliba doesn't make any sense to me. If he hated William Saliba wouldn't be starting the first game of the Premier League season away from home at Crystal Palace to make his Premier League debut. That just doesn't happen. If the manager doesn't rate a player and doesn't like a player, that doesn't happen. And I think, you know, I hope it will be borne out over the course of the season. You know, this guy looks like someone who's going to raise the level of this football team at the back defensively. Yeah. And I just don't really see the point in arguing the toss over some stuff that, you know, is basically the result of all of us having far too much time to talk amongst ourselves about football.
And I think, to be honest, the rest of the league have slightly slept on Saliba coming back to Arsenal and what a boost that is. And, you know, as I've said in here before, I really didn't believe it would get to this. And I'm so thrilled that it has. And he, he did really well. Like I said, I think there are different kinds of tests ahead and different kinds of centre forwards and people who are going to run in behind him or try and drag him out into the channels and, you know, different elements to see. And consistency will be key, you know, be a key marker. But you can't help but be excited by what you've seen. And he's putting himself into a very strong position, not just within the Arsenal squad, but also with reference to potential contract negotiations.
Yeah. So look, he was, I think, the big positive on the night because of just everything that went into that debut and just how good it was. But in conclusion, coming back to where we started, 3 points, clean sheet, 2 goals, positive goal difference, a win away from home. You know, the belief and the optimism that people had going into a new season, as we always say, like, results determine how you feel about things. You know, you can look at a plan and say, that's a great plan. You can look at a transfer window and say, those are good signings. You can look at a manager or a coach and say, he knows his shit from a tactical perspective, et cetera, et cetera. But results dictate pretty much everything. And, you know, I was so, not that I was afraid of it, but I was just so glad that we kicked off the season with a win to sort of, you know, you feel like you've taken a couple of steps forward in the window, in preseason, what you've done, et cetera, et cetera. You don't want to, like, take one back. So just from the result perspective, I'm delighted that we got off to a win and you know, hopefully it settles everyone down, continues to build the confidence. And like you say, there's some games coming up that you're looking at and thinking, you know, we could really get off to a good start this season.
Yeah, and I've relived the start to last season more than once via the documentary, which I've seen a couple of times, and I have no great desire to do that again. And I do think your first game of the season is incredibly important. I think it sets a tone, and we got the right result, and it means that, you know, things feel a lot healthier. And I'm genuinely really excited to be at the Emirates next weekend. I think there's going to be a big buzz, and I'm glad that that's being maintained through pre-season. So, and also, you know, in a pure, as the most basic of terms, it's 3 points that we didn't get last season away to Palace. So an improvement for sure. And also room to improve in the performance.
Of course.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I think as a coach, you're probably looking at it and thinking, well, there's stuff I can work on here in the week. And, you know, you'd rather be doing that on the cushion of 3 points than not.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Was there anything else you wanted to touch on before we move on and do some questions in part two?
I'm sure it will all come up in the questions.
No doubt.
Yeah, let's go on to that.
All right. We will do that. We'll take a short break. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog. Also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon, patreon.com/ArsBlog. If you'd like to sign up and support everything that we do on the site heading into a new season and get extra podcasts, including an episode of Waffle coming this week, I think. Before we get into the questions, actually, I just wanted to have a quick chat about All or Nothing, the documentary. Have covered it over on Patreon. Myself and Phil Costa did an episode on the episodes 1 to 3. So you can go over and listen to that on Patreon after you finish this, if you haven't already had a chance to listen to it. But I did want to ask you what you thought of the show and what we've seen from it on this more public podcast.
I've enjoyed it. Did you expect to enjoy it? I really enjoyed it. I knew I would, because I'm an Arsenal fan, and as I've said on the show before, like, I'm the kind of guy who gets a kick out of watching tunnel cams and anything that's like an insight. I wouldn't be doing the work that I'm doing if I wasn't interested in sort of what it's like in that dressing room environment. So any insight into that is fascinating. And in fact, I'm feeling something already this season of like the all or nothing effect, which is that, you know, say after the Crystal Palace game, I'm kind of almost frustrated or disappointed that I'll never see what happened in that dressing room. Do you know what I mean? It's like I've been spoiled now. Yeah. It's been open to me. And now I'm like, well, just let me see every team talk in a way. But I have enjoyed it. I had quite realistic expectations, I think. You know, I knew it was going to be a heavily curated thing. And I don't think it's particularly newsy. Like, I don't think there's like massive stories or things we didn't know about in there, but it's the human element that I find interesting, you know, the insight into the personalities, you know, stuff like working one-to-one with Smith Rowe and the insights Arteta makes about his character. I think the Nuno Tavares stuff is fascinating, almost especially in the light of the recent decision to send him out on loan. I like kind of seeing, you know, the players' families, the stuff with the Ramsdales is great, and I think humanizes them. I have to say, like, somebody said to me on Twitter, and they were like, you know, when you watch something like this, it almost makes you think twice about some of the stuff you say or tweet about players. And I was like, well, if that's the only thing that this documentary does, I'm not saying you shouldn't criticize players, it's more just kind of the manner and the nature of that, then that's quite valuable. I've enjoyed it as an entertainment show. Like, it really plays to my sensibilities. What about you?
Yeah, I've liked it. I have to say, like you, I think the human aspect of, you know, the players is something that we often, not often, but is maybe taken for granted, or people don't think about it enough. Like, I was talking to Phil about this on the other podcast. So, but, you know, even someone like
Kieran, is that on Patreon? If people,
it's on Patreon, yeah, if people want to listen. But, you know, even someone like Kieran Tierney, you know, he didn't come from South America, where it's hot all the time, to rainy London, you know, where he doesn't understand the language or anything like that. He came from Glasgow, and he still
understands his language. Yeah. To be fair.
And he still had like issues of homesickness and depression. Maybe not helped by the big injury he picked up in his first season, et cetera, et cetera.
He had one of the hardest adaptations of any player coming into Arsenal in recent years.
Because
you have to remember, no player could be more embodied in the fabric of a club than Tierney was at Celtic.
Sure, sure.
And so to go away from that is a huge wrench. So that stuff is fascinating. Obviously, the manager is a big focus, and I guess like, one of the things I'm learning about the documentary is kind of you take your biases into it. So if you're inclined to think that if you have a positive opinion of the manager, then there's a lot in the documentary that will kind of play that out for you. And I think if you have a negative one, you can probably find things to ridicule him.
Sure. I think some of the things that went around on social media are much better in the context of the documentary than standalone things.
And I could give two hoots what a fan of another club thinks.
I couldn't give a shit about that. But, you know, what I think it's sort of worth remembering that this is like Arsenal-themed light entertainment for the semi-interested sports fan, football fan, or maybe not even football fans at all. It's not really, really for Arsenal fans. even though we're the ones who are most interested in it.
And we'll take the most from it, for sure, I think.
Exactly. But, you know, those things like the rubbing the hands together or, you know, the doodles on the whiteboard, you know, the two testicles and the Mickey. You know, things like that are just, they're the things that we're being shown in the context of this TV program. We're not seeing the nuts and bolts of training. We're not getting
the tactical briefings.
We're not getting all of the detailed preparation that goes into a game. We're seeing like a couple of minutes before kickoff, you know, a team talk, you know, an exercise, whatever it is. And those are the things that make for good TV, but they're not really representative of all the work that Mikel Arteta does. He's not just sort of sitting there going like, what slightly quirky thing will I think of today?
Cartoon am I going to draw next week?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I think you have to bear that in mind as well. But, you know, I am enjoying it, I have to say. I like some of the reactions. The stuff where they're least aware of the cameras is probably my favorite stuff.
Mm. Probably more like the dressing rooms.
Yeah, like Ramsdale coming in after the Villa game, absolutely fuming that he didn't get his, they fucking didn't get me bastard clean sheet, whatever it is he said. Yeah. You know, things like that. And then Arteta, you know, at one point he's just having a conversation with one of the coaches. Maybe it was in relation to, I don't know, whether it was himself or whether it was a player in particular. I can't quite remember. But he's just talking about, you know, the press in England, the way they build you up. Could have been about Saka, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, they build you up and then they bring you down and they're killing you. They're absolutely killing you. You know, things like that, I think, are the most interesting aspects. And, you know, the sort of set piece stuff, if you like, is the least interesting and certainly the stuff that most people might raise an eyebrow at if they're thinking of watching the program or not watching the program. But they're not really the important parts for me anyway.
Yeah, I think obviously I would be alarmed if all our manager did was get people to rub their hands together and draw cartoons. But I don't for a second think that's the case. It's just the less sensitive stuff to show. I mean, Arsenal aren't going to expose any of the kind of inner tactical workings of the club. And you know, that's it. Arteta makes the point himself several times in the documentary, that work happens during the week. What happens in the hour before the game is about emotion and motivation. They know everything else. Right?
Exactly.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But he's got to come up with 38 games plus 10 cup games or whatever it might be worth of stuff to keep these players engaged and energized. And you can bet your bottom dollar there'll be some weird ideas along the way. But as long as it's stimulating, then I guess he'll consider that a success. I actually think maybe the most interesting moment in the first three episodes for me, about the manager anyway, is the conversation between Edu and Steve Round in the canteen when Arsenal have started winning a couple of games and are picking up a bit of form. And Edu says to Steve Round, Mikel looks a bit better to me. I always said when he starts to build personal relationships with the players, he'll go to another level because tactically he's top.
Yeah.
And it's just because, you know, that's sort of been something we've wondered about from the outside. Kind of, I don't think anyone really questions Arteta's sort of tactical brain. I think most of us know he has a very in-depth, thorough understanding of the detail of games. We hear that from players constantly. But that interpersonal dynamic is something we've wondered about more.
Mm.
And I do think in the documentary, you kind of can see that, you know, there is something there. There is clearly a connection building.
Yeah. You can see he works hard at it, doesn't he? You know, he talks about them not being numbers at one point, doesn't he? My players aren't numbers. Like he said in Spain, some coaches are like a player is a number. And he talked about that. And I think he has worked really hard to cultivate the kind of dressing room environment that he thinks is a positive one.
Mm. But I think as well, the thing about Arteta, and this is my sort of slight, what's the word? This is my impression rather than something I know as a fact. But it seems like he also has the capacity to kind of turn the tap of that emotion off very swiftly when required. And that, I've had a little look further ahead via a preview of episodes 4 and 5, which deal with kind of the Aubameyang situation and go a bit further into that than I thought they might. And it's interesting to see kind of the other side of that coin. You know, he's someone who's all about emotion, all about connection. But when he needs to be cold, I think he absolutely has that capacity as well. Which I guess is useful. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, I'm looking forward to seeing the next three when they drop. And as I said, there is a longer podcast over on Patreon right now. You can have a listen to that. You know, obviously, it includes spoilers in inverted commas, but look, we all were there last season. We saw what happened. We know how it happened.
Spoiler, we don't get something.
Yeah, exactly. It's not quite a whodunit, is it? Let me just do this before we get on with the questions. Where is it gone? For goodness sake. There it is. Okay. It comes from Mr. Black Squid on the Discord, who says, goodly morning. Not a question, really, but I notice you two never remember whose turn it is to ask the first question. So last season, I kept track. Andrew, 29. James, 13. Tayo, 1. Plus or minus a few. And he says, needless to say, I think it's James's turn to ask the first question. I think you're overdue a few firsts here. So please be my guest.
The thing is, what you have to realize, listeners, is that neither of us want to go first, because that means we have to have something prepared. So it's sort of...
that's all or nothing kind of insight.
Poison
there,
chalice. Okay. We had quite a lot of questions about substitutions. So James, who's on Twitter at the Arsenal Times, says, good morning. I know it's only the first game, but are you concerned with the timing of the substitutions? Thought they came really late. And personally, also think Sambi and Eddie could have made a difference earlier. An area for me, Arteta has to improve on. And then just to sort of to add to that, Hugh Carpenter said, goodly morning. Do you think the lack of changes until 83 minutes tells us we're still short of quality outside the favoured 12 or 13? Obviously, Tierney was a fitness thing, but if we had more genuine like-for-like replacements on the bench, would we have seen changes earlier?
That kind of goes back to the discussion we were making in part one, where you're looking at the bench going, well, what do I do? Like, you don't bring Pepe on.
What was
on
the bench? Let's have a look. Can we have a look?
Yeah, we can have a look here.
So the bench was... Turner as a goalkeeper, Tierney, Holding, Cedric, Sambi, Nelson, Elneny, Pepe, and Nketiah.
Yeah. So I was looking at it thinking, you know, particularly when we got to about the hour mark and Palace were very much on top, I was looking at it going, what should he do? What should he do to change it? Because I wonder if he was like, well, we're relatively comfortable. We're dealing with them pretty well defensively, even if we're not necessarily creating a lot. So what do you do? I mean, do you take off Bukayo Saka and put on Pepe at 1-0 away from home? I don't think that's the change. I don't think that's the change to make.
I was thinking... in the stands, I found myself wondering about a kind of third central midfield player.
Yeah.
Maybe at the expense of Odegaard. That was what I was thinking watching it. Just felt like a battle we weren't on top of.
Yeah. But I do think, was it the first question or the second question that asked, like, do we have enough quality or is there enough like-for-like replacements?
That was the second question.
And I think that is... I think that's the key part. As I said, if you'd had Vieira, if you'd had Smith Rowe, I think you might be more willing to make an earlier change. I think the changes that we did make actually had an impact. You know, when you look at the second goal,
I do think they had a big impact. Yeah.
Why is Kieran Tierney lurking around in this sort of center forward position? Because it's a long ball from, I think it's Ramsdale. You know, we have the ball at the back and Ramsdale plays it long to Kieran Tierney. I'm just going to see if I can... I'm just going to see if I can get it up here again. We're playing around with the ball. Tierney has it. We go backwards, I think, and it ends up with, yeah, Tierney's got it. He's pointing backwards. He's on the halfway line, and he's making a run forward. And now the ball's gone back to Ramsdale, who's had a look, sees Tierney, who's still in the opposition half,
yeah,
nods it down, and then, of course, it comes to Xhaka, to Nketiah, to Saka, and then that forces the own goal, and Eddie, you know, does well to spread it wide and, you know, maybe a little lucky on the own goal. But, you know, it was one of the most threatening aspects of the second half from an Arsenal perspective. So the two substitutes made an impact. Should we have made them earlier? I don't know. I mean, I don't quite know what else he could have done. I don't think Odegaard had his best game by any stretch of the imagination. But you do fancy him to be able to make a pass as and when you might need one if you do get a bit more possession. So I think he was probably just holding on to see if we could change the momentum ourselves. And then when we didn't, you're looking at it going, maybe we just only have late subs here. So I do think there's room for more quality on the bench, for sure. For sure.
Yeah, and some of that will come back with injury. You know, even as well as we think Ben White acquitted himself, the fact that he was on a booking, if Tomiyasu had been fit and you could have brought him on, you know, just to give you a bit of extra security, you might well have done it on that right-hand side.
That's another aspect of Ben White's performance, by the way, that, you know, he dealt well with the booking.
Yeah, true. True. So. And then Tierney for Zinchenko was a really, I think, good change to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a better one-on-one defender probably, and brought some energy. I thought Eddie looked sharp, actually, when he came on, as he has done throughout pre-season. And, you know, again, gave us some energy in the front line, which we needed. So the changes worked well. I do think it is surprising on the sort of first day of the reintroduction of five subs to get to 83 minutes without one.
Mm.
And like you, I do think it speaks to maybe a slight lack of faith in those guys on the bench. I mean, I'm hopeful that, you know, when we get our players back, we won't feel that way. But, you know, and Arteta's pretty clear as well that there's still potentially some work to be done in the transfer market. So that could help as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking, you know, this season when we're in a position like this, you know, 1-0 away from home is a good position to be in. Like, I don't necessarily want to see the Rob Holding substitution too much.
No, but it's kind of encouraging that it didn't come to that.
That's what I mean. Because when I was thinking of changes, I was going, like, is he going to do it? Is he going to do that? Is he going to put, you know, at 80 minutes, is he just going to put Rob Holding on and hang on to it? Whereas, you know, Tierney for Zinchenko, like for like. Eddie for Gabriel Jesus, like for like, in terms of position. So you're not necessarily making yourself more defensive. I don't think we made ourselves particularly more offensive or added to the attack. But I think that there might be times where where maybe we just throw on another attacking player or two to try and change the momentum of a game.
I mean, like you say, it's not like Tierney sat in. You know, he was still pushing forward. Mm. I do think there might have been a case to have Jesus and Nketiah, because Palace were playing so effectively out of the back, you know, it might have been worth having two strikers just really from a defensive perspective. But anyway, look, he made the changes he did. I was a little bit surprised, actually, that he brought Jesus off. I know he'd got through a lot of work.
Yeah.
There was that great moment where he won the ball on the right-hand side, sort of chasing a lost cause, and Arsenal probably should have made more of that opportunity. But, you know, I thought the subs helped. I would have probably made a change a little bit earlier if I was in charge, but I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, you know, like you say, when we're talking about improving the level of performance, something Mikel Arteta will undoubtedly want, you know, I think when you can go into a game and identify, okay, there's still work to do, and we know there's still work to do, but, you know, where it becomes quite obvious that you're missing something from the bench, to be able to acknowledge that after a 2-0 win is a good thing, rather than saying, fuck, that not having that player really cost us. You know what I mean?
True.
So it's a good thing. This one comes from Anon. On the Discord. I don't know who he is. He says, goodly morning, chaps. You've both got dogs and have probably tried a few different training techniques. How best do you think Mikel Arteta can teach Martin Odegaard to shoot when he's one-on-one with the keeper?
He needs a clicker. And every time Arteta clicks it, Odegaard shoot. And he'll probably be hearing that in a 6,000-seater stadium. I mean, I've just seen that again, actually, while we were talking. I was sort of scrubbing through the highlights and I was at the other end of the pitch to it.
Mm.
He really, really, really should have taken that shot on. I know it's kind of pure Arsenal to not, you know, it's memories of Mesut Ozil and Alexander Kleb and many other predecessors. But I want to see Odegaard shooting there and taking that responsibility on. I think he's good enough. I think he has the technique. And I think given the position that he plays and the role in the team, he needs to be thinking about his numbers, you know, looking at his goals and assists this season and trying to get those up in the double figures.
I think he should. I'm watching it back here.
I don't think his first touch is the best.
I don't think the pass is as good as it could be.
Yeah,
like, I think if you're Gabriel Jesus, you should be playing that pass onto Martin Odegaard's left foot, knowing he's a left-footed player, and playing it across him so he can basically take a first-time shot. I don't think he did that. I don't think Odegaard's touch was quite what it should have been. And then he was obviously trying to just play it back for Martinelli, who was looking for it there. But yeah, look, I think one of the things about Martin Odegaard that has improved in recent, or certainly last season, was A, the amount of goals, and B, the amount of shots he took, and the number of times he got into the box in that position. So I don't have a huge concern over it. Like I said, I don't think he had his best game on Friday night, but I'm sure he will do better in situations like that.
Yeah, it is also slightly in his nature to kind of to pick the more technically secure route to goal. You know, like, I think he would, if he feels like getting a touch and playing a pass here creates a better opportunity, he is kind of inclined to do that rather than take a swing with his right foot or whatever it might be. I don't know if that is going to come out of his game. I think it's kind of partly who he is. But yeah, listen, I thought he had a quite a difficult night. And something I wondered was kind of, I found myself in game thinking, like, I wonder if the armband makes any difference in Arteta's decision making about substitutions. One would hope not and imagine not. And Odegaard did eventually come off, right, for Sambi. So you'd imagine not. But I did just find myself wondering that because I was looking at it thinking, he's probably the player I'd bring off, but he's also the captain. Is that a conflict? Yeah. I hope it isn't, basically.
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, ultimately, whoever's wearing the armband, he will make the right decision, what he feels is the right decision, you know, for the team in the context of the game. And I think the players will understand that as well. We had a question, actually. I can't find it. Typically, I can't find it. But it was basically like, do you make anything of the fact that Xhaka was given the armband when Odegaard went off?
Yeah, I do make something of it. I think, I just think Xhaka is part of the leadership group, you know? And so he was one of the natural choices. But there is a significance. You know, you can't help but notice it happened against Crystal Palace as well. I know he's done it once or twice since then. But, you know, Crystal Palace was obviously the team where he lost it. I think I don't think it's anything hugely noteworthy, but clearly he is, you know, he's part of that group, if not the actual guy with the armband week in, week out. And that speaks to his kind of continued rehabilitation, I guess.
Okay. Question?
Oh, what about this? Herr Tolf says, how good is the new Zinchenko song, and why is it the greatest ever?
I did like that because I was listening, you know, on the TV. I was going, are they? Is that, I know that song. Are they singing that for Zinchenko? Oh yeah, I like it. It is good. I like when a song just sort of appears out of nowhere. You know the way, like, you see stuff on Twitter, or you might get the occasional email. Where somebody says, this would be an amazing song for the player, and they've sort of written out the entire lyrics for Bohemian Rhapsody, but you know, it's somehow related to a footballer, and it's never going to work. And they very rarely do. But that just sort of popped up out of nowhere, and it sounds great, doesn't it? It really does sound great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if Manchester City sang it. I certainly hadn't heard it before, if they did. And did you see Martin Kemp, who I think is an Arsenal fan?
Yes.
Did a little video of him singing it as well, which is good.
Yeah, it was. Let me see. Is it my question?
It is.
I think it is. Okay. One from Tristan on the Discord. He said, with fans having more resources, like this podcast, for quality analysis and discussion, thank you very much, it seems like punditry is falling behind. Pundits aren't as educated on each team's finer details and end up saying things that make us all go, Or maybe that Bukayo Saka noise. For example, saying Odegaard isn't a typical captain when we know he really is. What do you think is the solution? Or are we just going to keep getting punditry that doesn't make sense?
Well, to be fair to them, I take their point on Odegaard. It depends on what your definition of a typical captain
Yeah, I think
is,
this is right? more just sort of a general point.
I think in general, I understand. Basically, it's impossible, isn't it? For a pundit to be as clued in as someone who is obsessed as we are with the fine detail of our club and our team.
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty sympathetic to that position. And I do think, like, the limited contact I've had with somebody like Jamie Carragher, I do think that he actually does work quite hard to get to that detail as far as he can, and, you know, try and understand what the fans are thinking, but also what the team are doing in games they're not seeing. But it's not really, it's never going to be as in depth. But I think what you have to remember is the audience is so different. It's a bit like what we were saying about All or Nothing. You know, the general football watching audience aren't watching Arsenal week in, week out either. And so these things, as much as they annoy us, the millions of people who are tuning in just, you know, casually, it's not grating for them. And I guess they're being catered to more than us. And that's why there is a place in all this for fan media or more specific detailed coverage, because, you know, it's a different audience.
Yeah, and look, I think I understand as well from a specific fan perspective, whether you're an Arsenal fan or a Liverpool fan or whatever, and you hear a pundit or a commentator say something that just doesn't ring true.
Yeah.
You know, there is an element of, look, you've got a very good job here. I'm not talking about just some kind of washed up Spurs twat who ends up on TalkSport. I think we all understand that the level of discourse is going to be, you know,
that's designed to be inflammatory.
Yeah.
You know?
And stupid by its very nature. But I think when somebody is, you know, one of the main pundits on something like Sky Sports, that's a well-paid gig. And maybe the best pundits or the ones who come across best are the ones who do their research a bit more, who maybe reach out to fans of a club that they're covering that weekend to ask about certain things or you know, find out what the mood is about this, that, or the other, so I think there is an onus when you're in a very well-paid position to do the best job you can possibly do. Some of them will just take the money and just waffle. Others will, you know, actually spend time to try and do the best job that they can. And that, I think, comes down to each individual as much as anything. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think, in a way, like, as frustrating as it is for everyone, in a way, it means that, you know, people who are more, what's the word, specialists, that it creates a need for that. So, you know, I'm not going to complain too much because, you know, that's sort of where we sit, I guess.
Yes.
As pretentious as that might sound, to call ourselves specialists. But I mean more in terms
no,
of the
I know.
Focus.
Yeah, just,
and
yeah,
the
exactly. Exactly.
What about this? James Palmwell, it's a little bit, sideways, but I think it's interesting. How good a manager is Patrick Vieira? Do you think he'll get a job at a top tier club someday?
I mean, he might. He might. Mm. He seems, you know, again, to sort of hark back to my conversations with Dan from HLTCO, loves him. Absolutely loves him.
Yeah, they do love him at Palace.
Loves the impact that he's had on the team, the way it plays, but also what he does at the football club and how involved he is at every level, you know?
He's been great with like their community projects and stuff like that. He's really engaged at sort of grassroots level.
You know, we know he was an amazing player. We know as well that amazing players don't always make amazing managers, but that's not a hard and fast rule by any means. I mean, I think he's doing a very good job at Crystal Palace. I don't know what exactly or how far he can take them, but I think it speaks to the job that he's doing. You know, when we were thinking about this game beforehand, we were, you know, we're not taking anything for granted. There was a measure of worry as well, wasn't there? Because we saw what they did to us last season. We know what they're capable of. And that in many ways is down to the way the manager has them working. So if we have that sort of fear in our minds, it suggests that Patrick Vieira is doing a very good job there. I think there's probably a ceiling. There's always going to be a ceiling with a club like Palace. And I don't mean that to be disrespectful to them in any way. But there probably is, just based on the resources and what you're fighting against, there's probably only so far you can go with a club like that. You know, there's only so high you can take them. I guess it's then down to other clubs, perhaps with more potential, to say, well, look what he's done there. Can he translate that at our club into getting us, you know, further up the table or you know, the success that we want? But look, I think he's doing a fantastic job. And, you know, when you're doing it in the Premier League, you know, people take notice. They really do take notice because of the spotlight and the money and the players that are in the Premier League, et cetera, et cetera. I think he's doing a very good job. I mean, what do you reckon?
I think he's got a chance, definitely. I think I could see it, you know, him getting a good job. I could see a world where he could get a job at Arsenal one day. It's hard because the fortunes of managers can change so quickly and their reputation can rise or fall very swiftly too. But he's got a very good grounding. He was part of that kind of City group, you know, after his time with Man City, working in sort of youth
New
development
York,
there, and then going out to New York. Yeah. I think he did, you know, they spoke very highly of his coaching in America. He did okay in France, a bit of a mixed spell, but he seems to have made a real impact at Palace. He's still a very commanding figure. You know, we use that word of William Saliba, but
yeah,
you know, I was in Patrick Vieira's press conference the other day and he's absolutely still got that presence. And, you know, he's a winner. He's a winner as a player. He was absolutely a winner and incredibly motivated and determined and driven. And I think he takes that into his management career. So I would never count against him.
Yeah.
And such a history at Arsenal as well. And I do think that that contributes, you know, that can be a factor in any appointment.
Of course, because, you know, if you're going to go to a big club, maybe you need to understand a big club as well. Not saying it's absolutely necessary, but it might factor into the thinking of, you know, somebody who's looking to hire him and saying, you know, these are the standards that we expect at this club. So, look, I hope he does a great job at Palace and, you know, gets them as high up the table as he can. And
takes points off all the other
big teams. Exactly.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah, a couple of 4-0 wins over Tottenham would be great. So
I'll be rooting for him for a while now because it'll be a while till we play him again.
We'll leave that in your capable hands, Patrick, if you're listening, which of course you're not. Let's have a couple on this particular subject. Ian Wright, who's at IH Wright on Twitter. Sure. Not that Ian Wright, who is just taking time out of his day to take the piss out of Lord Amstrad. He said, I think everyone likes the player, but have we all made a too easy assumption that the centre-back pairing this season will settle on Gabriel plus one other? And on the Discord, there's a question from Sullyball2, who says, while he's often impressive in general play, I feel like Gabriel is a critical mistake away every game. Is Arteta wedded to a left-footed centre-back, or could we see a White-Saliba partnership in the future? I'd certainly like to see us try that when Tommy is back.
I did wonder about that, I have to say.
I thought part of what I thought was quite interesting about the Ben White thing in general, and I know he sort of, when he plays centre-back, he plays right centre-back, and Saliba's at right centre-back, so there's an immediate, like, well, he's in your position now, tough luck, son. What I did think was quite interesting was there was no real discussion of, like, well, what if it's Gabriel that makes way when Tommy Asu is fit again and we play a back four? Which I don't think is a ridiculous idea.
No. I don't think it is either. I think he is quite wedded to the idea of a left-footed centre-back. But I do wonder if the arrival of Zinchenko, who is so good building play out of that sort of area of the pitch, might slightly reduce the necessity. I think it's possible. I really am relaxed about the centre-backs and sort of who ends up playing.
Yeah.
I'm sure people will have their favourites and be disappointed if they're not the ones who make the cut. But I just think they're all going to play plenty of football, to be honest with you.
I agree. We had another question there is like, you know, what's your choice between Tierney and Zinchenko? And it's like, you know what?
We don't have to choose, really.
Yeah. I there might be games where Zinchenko is a better choice than Tierney, depending on the opposition. But like you, I'm just relaxed that we've got two good players. Similarly, with the centre halves, you know, to have three of the calibre of White, Saliba and Gabriel, good. I like it. And if somebody fucks up or somebody loses form, we've got somebody who can take their place. That's
I guess I kind of feel like at the moment, the four that started against Palace are likely to stay in possession just because I don't see anyone else being immediately ready to knock on the door. Tommy Asu played 45 minutes, didn't he, yesterday for the under-21s. Tierney obviously got 10 minutes against Palace, but I'm not sure I see either starting against Leicester. So these are the guys with the shirts, and I think that you know, they've got a good chance of holding on to them for this opening period of the season. But things change. I mean, you know, you're reminded of it watching All or Nothing. Nuno Tavares came into the team and played, what was it, half a dozen games, maybe more than that, with Kieran Tierney on the bench.
Yeah, the discussion.
Arsenal were winning those games.
Yeah. Do you remember we had on the podcast, is like, is this it now for Kieran Tierney?
Sure. And I think if White continues to do well at right back, people will probably say, raised question about Tommy Asu, but Tommy Asu was one of Arsenal's best players last season. I'm sure his time is going to come and he's going to contribute to this team. Do I think long term, like looking beyond this season, there might be a question about the centre halves and if they all want to stay, if they're not absolutely first choice? Maybe. I do think that, you know, I know it's something a lot of fans are talking about, but Saliba's contract is an interesting focus now. I mean, especially after that performance, you know, he could have a very big few months here where he could play a lot of football for Arsenal. He could go to the World Cup with France. France have got arguably the most talented squad in that World Cup. They could do very well indeed. You know, if he gets to January,
yeah,
a World Cup winner and regular at Arsenal with 18 months left on his contract, he's in a very, very strong position. And the club are in a vulnerable one, shall we say.
Yeah, sure.
So if I was the club, I'd be I'd be trying to accelerate that, especially while he's in the team and while he's playing and while he's feeling good. You know, let's at least protect ourselves on that front.
Yeah.
But in terms of who plays, yeah, I'd like to see a Saliba and White partnership, and I'm sure at some point in the season we will. I know we get very attached to this idea of he's a right-sided centre-back and he's a left-sided centre-back, but I'm sure that a decade ago or slightly more than that, there was a lot more flexibility about these things, and I don't doubt that they could do that job, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Have you got one more?
I don't know if I do actually, really. So if you've
we've
got
covered
one,
a lot.
Go for it.
I thought this one was, again, it's not really about the game or anything like that, but Big Sven on the Discord says, would love to know your
Sven
thoughts.
Sven Mislintat.
Big Sven. I don't know if it's Sven Mislintat or Sven Jorn Eriksson or Sven Svensson from Sweden.
Okay.
He said, I really enjoyed last night's game, or Friday night's game, the battle and the win, but also the refereeing. The game flowed much more than normal. I wasn't even annoyed Xhaka was booked for diving. The league has been getting so stop-start every season, and last year's officiating was the worst. Have the league turned a corner? Are the refs going to use common sense and let men play football and book actors? It'll never be perfect, but if it continues like last night, I'd be very happy.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like the referee let quite a lot go. I thought there were other refs who would have brought out more yellow cards on the night than the referee did. You know, there was a couple earlier on where the home crowd were really on the ref's back to, like, book Jesus or book White. And he resisted until Xhaka. That was the first booking, right? Just before half-time, the dive. Which, you know, probably was a dive, did you think?
I think it probably, it's one of those where he was definitely anticipating more contact.
I think he could have not booked him, to be honest.
I think so, particularly as Eze had one. There was one in the second half where he very clearly made the same, like, come on, get up thing. You know what? I think it might just take a bit of time for us to adjust to certain things because, look, I will say this. In my own mind, I want Arsenal players to be able to go out and smash the shit out of the opposition, you know, fairly but hard, you know.
Yeah.
But as soon as anyone touches any one of our players, even slightly, I want a free kick.
Sure.
I have noticed that. Yeah, that is just who I am. So there are going to be times where this season I'm going to get furious when the referee lets some relatively innocuous contact go, probably quite rightly, in order to let the game flow. So I might have to just recalibrate my brain a little. I suppose this will all just come down to consistency. Like, are they all going to do this? Is one referee going to do it more strictly than another? Is another referee just going to turn football into rollerball? You know, we're going to see maimings and all kinds. You know, that will be the thing I think that will continue to frustrate fans, but that's refereeing for you.
Maybe it was such a big narrative last season, the officiating, and if it isn't, then that will feel like dramatic progress.
Yeah.
And we didn't really have anything to say about the official in this game of any great note. So I would consider that a success.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, look, we'll see how that plays on. Right, we're going to leave it there. James and I will have a waffle for you on Wednesday. So if you're on Patreon, you can join us for that. We'll send out the call for your waffle questions during the week as well. But we do have something a bit special to finish off the show today. Do you want to expand on this a little bit before I hit play?
Well, you remember last week I mentioned that somebody on Twitter, Johnny, had sent me the lyrics to a reworked version of North London Forever called Fuck Magpies Forever. And after Arsenal started the season in such good form, you know, with a result that we all hoped for, I thought it only appropriate that I lay that track down. So that will play you out.
Yes. You've given the people what they really want. They've sat through 90 minutes of inane football chatter in order to hear what I think, you know, and I said this to you last night, is your most complete vocal performance ever. So
It's very moving.
I hope people enjoy it. Thank you, as always, for being here. Thank you for listening, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye. I want to thank Johnny, who's at Fruit All Sorts on Twitter, who wrote these lyrics and sent them in. And I want to thank a YouTube channel called Carto Guitar, from which I stole the backing track. As I walk these streets alone, through this borough I call home, down my spine I feel a shiver. There should be more hens on the river. Through the turnstiles of the Angel, I think I'm safe at last. But I hear the wings are beating, and they're beating fucking fast. Seek refuge in all the buildings and the offie on the corner. My knowledge is the logical, and the prefix is awning. A wren, a hawk, a blue tit are watching from the side, seeking solace from their sorrows, sheltering in a bird hide. Through the madness in the market, people look into the skies. Watch what you are doing, cause they'll peck out your eyes. Little Rosie approaches one, she doesn't have a clue that his heart is as black as his feathers and his shoes. Down towards the Emirates, I spot a ticket tout. Try giving him a warning by shouting, mate, watch out! From the Thornhill to the Hemi, I know what the people lack. Everyone will be running scared unless they've got some magpie facts. Fuck magpies forever!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.